Welcome back to the Series 7 Study Guide, the Series 7 Podcast. My name is Franz, I'm your host. Before we get into the lesson today, which is going to be lesson number 45 in the new second edition of the Series 7 Study Guide, it's going to be covering macro analysis, and it's about 39 minutes in length. I want to make an announcement. As you know, I have a passion, and the passion I have is sailing. And I have a long history of sailing, and it's a story I've told on my other podcast, which is called Sailing in the Mediterranean and Beyond Podcast. Well, if you've been listening to my podcast very long, you know that I usually go sailing for a couple months in the summer. And this year it's going to be no different. I'm going to be leaving on July 12th, flying over to Turkey, and then sailing my boat through Turkey and through Greece and then ending in Croatia at the end of the summer. I have some openings. And I've already put this out there to some of my listeners in the Sailing in the Mediterranean and Beyond podcast. But I also wanted to put it out to you. Now, this is different than Series 7 study. This is totally different. But if you have a interest in learning to sail, or a passion of just life in general, and you have the time, I'm going to go through the schedule of when I have openings. Now, usually I take clients with me, and I have clients going this summer, but I'm gone for 2 months. So that's basically 8 weeks, eight separate crew schedules. Actually, it's about seven different crew positions or crew changes during the summer. I usually let people come on for about a week, and then I kick them off. I don't like to be with people much longer than a week. But I've got an opening for the put-in crew, and I've got an opening for one person. And let me explain how this works. And if you're interested, you need to write me an email, either at franz1@medsailor.com or franz@series7podcast. And tell me about yourself. Give me your phone number. And I will give you a call and we'll talk about it. What I'm looking for in the first crew. So right now I've got myself and Mike Allgood, who's a retired investment banker. He's going to be joining me. And this is the put-in crew. You'd need to arrive in Bodrum, the town of Bodrum, Turkey, the morning of, or during the day of July 17th. We're going to be working on the boat in the boatyard for about a week. And during that week, I've got to have some work done on the boat. I'm not going to go into too much detail about it, but basically, I've got to have the forward hatch rebuilt on the boat and a little more work done on the boat. But while the yard is doing a lot of that work, we're going to go travel. We're going to rent a car or fly over to Cappadocia and travel around. So we're not going to be sitting around the boatyard. We'll probably have about 2, maybe 3 days of work in the boatyard. We're going to go do some land-based travel, and then we're going to get on the boat, launch it, sail over to Kos in Greece. We'll clear out of customs in Bodrum, Turkey, and we'll sail over to Kos. And then that crew will sail with me from Kos to Kalminos, Kalminos to Lipsi, Lipsi to Arki, Arki to Patmos, and that's where you're going to be getting off, the island of Patmos in Greece. So you would be joining me on July 17th in Bodrum. I'm personally flying over on the 15th. I arrive late at night in Bodrum. I fly Salt Lake to Paris, Paris to Istanbul, Istanbul to Bodrum. I arrive at Bodrum about 23:10, so about 11:10 at night, and then in the morning I'll head to the boatyard and start doing some work. And like I say, there's going to be a couple days, maybe 3 days of work in the boatyard, and the rest of the time, while we're waiting for glue to dry, basically, in the yard to do the work that needs to be done on the boat, we're going to go travel. We don't sit around. So that's the first crew. I have an opening for one person. Let me tell you who my ideal crew member would be. Somebody that's young, not too overweight. And the reason I say this is you may have to go up the mast to attach the attach a fitting to the mast. I'm 63 years old, and Mike's a little older than me, And so are you looking for a young buck that's strong, healthy, and it could be a woman too, doesn't matter. But it might be a little awkward with two old guys and a woman. So I'm, just be aware of that. But anyway, if you're interested in that crew, let me know. Mike Allgood's a really interesting person. He has a lot of stories to tell about finance and the investment banking world. He traveled around the world putting together investment banking deals. He's been a friend of mine for quite a while. He's a hunting companion of mine. We go hunting together, and this will be his first time on the boat. Now, I don't expect you to know how to sail. I know how to sail, but I'd be teaching you how to sail during that week of time. So the next crew, and I have an opening for one person. I have one person on the boat already, and he's a friend of mine, and he owns a newspaper in the Los Angeles area. He's the editor and owner of a newspaper in the Los Angeles area. He's British. He has great stories to tell, and he's a fun person. I've sailed with him twice, 2 years ago when he joined me on my boat for the first time. That was the first time I'd met him. He was a listener on my podcast, the Sailing in the Mediterranean and Beyond podcast. And so that was the first time I met him. And then last summer, I sailed with him on his boat up in Stockholm, the Swedish archipelago. So we've got one opening for one other crew member on that leg. And that would be arriving in Patmos, on the island of Patmos, on Monday, July 31st, and leaving on August 4th. We'll be sailing from Patmos to Heraklea, probably to Mykonos or Tinos, and then to Tinos, and then maybe back to Mykonos. But basically, you're probably going to be getting off in Mykonos, the Greek island of Mykonos, or Tinos. And they're very close. They're only a short ferry ride away from each other, about 10 miles by ferry from Mykonos to Tinos and vice versa. So that's the second crew opening. The third crew opening is a client. Fourth crew opening is a client. Fifth crew opening is a client. That's already booked up. And I have one other opening. And this is going to be a little more adventurous. This is on, you would join me in Corfu, Greece, on August 28th. And we will clear out of Greece and we will sail up to Montenegro. And this is 164 miles of open sea. So it'll be one or two nights at sea overnight. So, it's going to be adventurous. I've done lots of overnight sails. Remember, I sailed my boat across the Atlantic, and that was 21 days to the Azores and another 9 days from the Azores to Portugal. So I've done plenty of overnight sails. It's not a big deal, but if it's your first time, it's always exciting and a little bit nerve-wracking. So we'll be having a couple nights at sea. We'll arrive in Bar, Montenegro, clear customs at Bar, work our way up from Bar to Budva, and then up into the big fjord, the Montenegro fjord, and sail around the fjord for a while, and then you would leave me in Kotor, Montenegro. Now, you can fly out of Kotor or catch a bus and fly out of the Dubrovnik airport. Doesn't matter. Whatever works for you. And those are the crew openings I have. Now, on this crew from Corfu up to Montenegro, I have an opening for two people. I would prefer two different people, but if you have a companion that wants to join you, just be aware that this is a small boat. And if you're bringing a wife or a girlfriend with you, or a boyfriend with you, you have to like, if you don't like camping out, you're not going to enjoy my boat. And we'll just go into more detail if you write me a letter and get me more information about yourself. So if you're interested in that, expanding your horizons a bit, write me an email. Let me know. I'm leaving, like I say, the first crew is the one I need to fill up right away, because there's not that much time between now and then. The flight over there, the round-trip flight from Salt Lake to Istanbul is about $1,200. It's about the same anywhere in the United States. You might get a little cheaper, maybe a little more expensive, depending on where you're at. The flight from Istanbul down to Bodrum It's probably going to be about $50 to $75. And then you are responsible for all of your expenses, all of your own travel expenses, and so forth. So when we're traveling around, if we're renting a car, you're going to be paying a portion of that. If we share a hotel room, you're going to be paying a portion of that. If you get your own room, you're paying for your own room. That's just the way it is. I'm providing the boat and some instruction if you want it. All right, a little bit of announcement on the podcast. Right now, I've taken off the first edition of the Series 7 podcast from the website, the Series 7 study guide. That was the 53 lessons. I decided there's really no point in offering two different versions, an older version and a newer version. So if you want to buy the newer version, that's 58 lessons, and it's $79.99 for that edition. I think it's around 23 hours of instruction, audio instruction. I'd like to encourage you to sign up to the email list. If you sign up to the email list, you'll get an outline, about a 23 or 25 page outline. It's becoming a more and more difficult exam to pass. So if you'd like to sign up for that email list, what I do with that email list is I send you some offers from time to time. I give you notices of when the new episodes of this podcast come out. And I may add some access to some quizzes. I put up a sign-up sheet for the quizzes. I didn't get that many people that signed up for that email list. So I'm not going to set up the quizzes again, except for those who sign up for the email list. I may give you an opportunity to take some quizzes. Now, there's another big announcement. Hopefully, by the time I go sailing, and it may not get done in time, but I'm hoping it will, I will have the full 58 series of quizzes available. And I'm going to raise the price of the 58 lessons to $99.99. So basically about $100. But in addition to the 23, 24 hours of audio instruction, after each audio lesson, you will be given a quiz so that you can test yourself on the comprehension of the material that was covered in the audio lesson. And you can take these quizzes over as often as you want, as long as you save the link that I will send you in an email. So how this will work, when you buy the bundle of lessons, which will now go up to $99.99, it will include the quizzes. So that's where I'm adding additional value. And I think it's sort of pointless to be taking or listening to audio lessons and not testing yourself on the comprehension of the lesson as you go along. But these will come out to you in an email. So automatically when you buy the series of audio lessons, you'll be able to download the audio lessons or use Gumroad to listen to them in an app. But immediately when you sign up, you will get the first email, which will give you a link to the first quiz. Now, you can ignore that email for as long as you want. But when you're ready to take the quiz, go ahead and click on the link in the email, and it'll take you to the quiz, and you can test yourself on how you're doing. Immediately, when you click that link that takes you to that quiz, another email will come to you giving you the link to the next quiz. So you can go through these quizzes as fast or as slow as you want. And there is about 1,200 questions in the full series of quizzes. So that's that. So let me encourage you to sign up for the email list, get the free outline and free offers, other free offers as they come along, and notices of when I put out new episodes. Contact me if you're interested in sailing with me this summer, franz1@medsailor.com. Now, if you're going to contact me, I want you to go over and listen to some of my podcasts, the Sailing in the Mediterranean and Beyond podcast. There's 140 episodes over there. I don't think you can get all 140 on iTunes. You'd have to go to the website, which is MedSailor, MedSailor.com. But the earlier podcasts are at the website. But just get an idea of what I do and where I go sailing and the stories I tell. If you have no interest in that, you probably shouldn't be going sailing with me anyway. All right, enough of this preamble out of the way. By the way, when you buy the full series of lessons, if it's something that you think is valuable to you, you will not get these preambles in the lessons. It's straight into the material. You don't get any advertisements in the lessons or anything else. It's straight to the material. And I've had some great feedback from people. Thank you for those that have written me and told me how well you've done on the test as a result of listening to my lessons, my audio lessons. It really makes a difference to me. That makes the biggest difference to me. When it helps somebody pass a Series 7 exam, I really appreciate that. And I put some testimonials at the website if you want to take a look at that. The website, again, is series7podcast.com. All right, with that out of the way, let's learn about macroeconomic analysis. This is the Series 7 Study Guide, audio lessons for the FINRA Series 7 exam, second edition. And this is lesson number 45, macroeconomic analysis. In this lesson, we're going to be talking about economic analysis. You need to understand some basic economic analysis and some basic terms used to describe economic analysis in the news media for passing the Series 7 examination. First of all, let's talk about, and you may already know this, but this is going to be a review if you don't know this, but let's talk about what is gross national product and gross domestic product. You will hear these numbers bandied about all the time. So let's first of all describe and define what gross domestic product is. Now I'm going to a website called Wikipedia. Let's start out with gross national products, and then we'll contrast that with how that differs from gross domestic product. Gross national product is all the products and services produced in 1 year by labor and property supplied by the residents of a country. So what this means is if you're a resident of the United States, but you live in Europe, you're still considered part of the gross national product for the United States. Or if you're a corporation that does business overseas, the value of the products and services produced by that corporation overseas is still considered part of the gross national product of the country from where you come from or for the business is domiciled. So this includes all those multinational companies, the income, the products, the services that they produce in a year is considered part of the gross national product. So the big difference is where the gross national product is all the products produced by the residents or citizens or corporations of a country are part of that country's gross national product. Where gross domestic product differs in that the gross domestic product is the market value of all goods and services produced within a country in a given period of time, usually a year. Now, interestingly enough, they are usually within 1 percentage point of each other. So quite often you will hear use one term and another term, and the reality is they don't differ that much from either one, gross domestic product versus gross national product. Probably it's better to use gross domestic product, but that's the two differences between them. There's actually several different ways to calculate gross domestic product. Here's one way. Gross domestic product equals private consumption. Now these are going to be in dollar terms, plus gross investment, plus government spending, plus exports minus imports. That's one way. And all of these should basically give you the same number. Another way is gross domestic product equals the compensation of employees plus the gross operating surplus, that would be the profits of a company, plus gross mixed income, and that would be basically the small business income, plus taxes, less subsidies on production and imports. Another way to calculate gross domestic product, and by the way, you don't need to know these formulas, but I'm just going to give them to you. Gross domestic product equals rents plus interest plus profits plus statistical adjustments, and I'm reading here from Wikipedia, which is corporate income taxes, dividend, undistributed corporate profits, plus wages. Then there's the expenditure approach, which is gross domestic product is the sum of consumption plus investment plus government spending, and then the difference of exports minus imports. That could be a positive or a negative. In the U.S., that's primarily a negative. We tend to import more than we're exporting now. So there's a few other formulas that basically give you the same sort of number. But bottom line is, gross domestic product is the products produced within a geographic region of a country, where gross national product is the products and services produced by the residents of a country, regardless of where they produce those goods and services. You may hear people, and I've heard this argument quite often, that Americans are a wasteful group of people. And you will often hear this when people are talking about electricity usage or energy usage and how much we consume relative to the rest of the world. The best way to puncture a hole in that argument is say, well, okay, let's bring that back to the gross national product or the gross domestic product and really compare, for every dollar of gross domestic product that we produce, how much energy do we use? And I've used this argument, and it really pretty much punctures the whole argument that we're a wasteful nation on energy. And I posted a couple links to this data. And this is directly from the World Bank Org indicator. And this is for the period of 2012. For every dollar of gross domestic product the United States produced, we used, and this is an equivalent BTUs, the term on this is GDP, gross domestic product, per unit of energy use. And they're using a 2005 constant dollar. And the energy use they're using is per kilogram of oil equivalent. So the United States, for every dollar of gross domestic product, used 6.3 equivalent energy units. Remember, lower is better. Let's just compare that to a few countries. Well, Portugal used 10.1. Poland used 7.3. The Slovak Republic, 6.9. Slovenia, 7. Spain, 9.8. We're lower than all of those so far. The United Kingdom, 10.8. I don't see any that are lower than the United States in this data. And here's one. Korea, 5.3. Korea's lower than the United States. Japan, 8.9. Italy, 10.1. Ireland, 12.6. Here's one that doesn't use much energy. Iceland, 1.8. And why? Because they have huge geothermal resources that they're able to use. Hungary, 7.2. Greece, 9.1. Germany, 9.3. Here, Finland's actually a little lower, 5.1 for Finland. France, 7.8. So you can look at this data, and it pretty much punctures the argument that we are a wasteful nation on energy usage. We are not, when you compare it and you bring it back to the gross domestic product. All right, enough on that subject. Now, let's talk about some other terms that you need to know. Well, the Consumer Price Index. Everybody talks about the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. What does the Consumer Price Index include? Well, I went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics to get the information right from the source. Here's what it includes. Foods and beverages, housing, apparel, transportation, such as new vehicles, airline fares, gasoline, motor vehicle insurance, medical care, recreation, such as television, cable TV, pets and pet products, education and communication, that's college tuition, postage, telephone service, computer software and accessories, other goods and services, such as tobacco, smoking products, hair products. What it does not include are Social Security taxes, income taxes, the value of securities, bonds, and real estate. And they will manipulate the Consumer Price Index. They will substitute a cheaper product for a more expensive product. For instance, and this is where these numbers manipulate, this basket is not set. For instance, let's say when you started the basket, beef and chicken were selling at exactly the same price. And suddenly beef becomes more expensive, they will just substitute all chicken and not account for the increase in price of beef because it's a meat. So they'll choose a cheaper product. They will also say that the computers are more valuable because they're faster, to lower the CPI index. The CPI index is manipulated, but nonetheless, that is the index that you need to understand. What does it include? Now, quite often, they will exclude food and fuel from the core CPI. So the core CPI excludes fuel and energy. And quite often, that's the number that they will use for cost of living increases. In the price of housing, in 1983, I'm reading this right from Wikipedia, in January 1983, housing prices were replaced with owner's equivalent of rent because rents were more stable. Housing prices rose and fell more than rents. Well, they didn't really fall that much in 1983. They rose. So to avoid that increase in the CPI, they replaced the price of housing with the price of rent. This is a number that's manipulated to try to achieve a result. But nonetheless, the consumer price index is something you need to know. Let's define what a recession is. A recession is when gross national product drops for two consecutive quarters. If the drop continues for at least 18 months, then it's considered a depression. That's what the definition of a recession is. GNP drops for two consecutive quarters. That's a recession. Depression, a drop in GNP for 18 months. You need to know what monetary policy is and fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is what our legislators control, our politicians, their tax increases, their tax decreases. It's government spending. It's where they spend the money. It's what our governments, the purse strings that basically the government controls. Monetary policy is what the Federal Reserve Board controls. That's the price of money, the rate of interest, how much banks can borrow from each other. Very different. Monetary policy, the Fed controls. Fiscal policy, the government controls. Right now, we have very, very low interest rate. The monetary environment is that of easy money. When they raise interest rates, the monetary environment is that of tight money, where it's harder to get loans or loans are more expensive. There's a few economic theories that you need to have a real basic understanding of. The Keynesian theory, the monetarist theory, the supply side theory. Interesting, they really don't talk about the Austrian theory, but you may want to read up on that as well. Keynes was famous for his quote, "In the long run, we're all dead." And it comes from Keynes' tract on monetary reform from 1923, where he was talking about if a factory closes, in the long run, the workers will find some jobs elsewhere, but in the short run, there may be considerable unemployment. The full quote is, "But this long run is a misleading guide to current affairs. In the long run, we're all dead. Economists set themselves too easily, too useless a task in a tempestuous season. They can only tell us that when the storm is past, the ocean is flat again." Keynes has been pretty much responsible for the theory which Roosevelt used in the Great Depression and which our government has used, or at least our Federal Reserve Board has used since the 2008 stock market collapse, in that when consumers are not willing to spend, government has to step in and spend to keep the economy moving. That's the basics of the Keynesian approach, that when there is a lack of demand from the private sector, in order to keep plants operating and governments working and people employed, then the government needs to deficit spend in order to keep the economy moving. That's the Keynes theory. The monetarists were pretty much the Chicago School of Economics. It came from the Chicago School of Economics. And the man really responsible for that is Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman said that the driving force behind economic cycles was primarily the Federal Reserve Board in how they determined the cost of money. he discounted the ability of the fiscal policies to affect long-term economic cycles and placed that squarely at the foot of the Federal Reserve Board. The supply side theory came from, I think it really was made popular when Reagan was the president of the United States. But the supply side theory basically says, let's lower taxes, let's lower interest rates, let's get the government out of excessive meddling because it stifles individual initiative. If we reduce this, then prosperity will follow. So unlike Keynes, it said the government needs to get involved, the supply-sider said the government needs to stay out of the way, to quit taxing so much, to quit meddling so much. The interesting side note about this is even though this was famous during the Reagan administration, government spending actually went up during the Reagan administration. It's never gone down. Government spending has never gone down from one administration to another, regardless of whether it's Republican or Democrat. The key to the supply siders, they said, we need to give the incentives to the private sector and the benefits will flow down through the economy. We all have heard about inflation. Inflation is the devaluation of your money. Deflation is the increased value of your money. The history of the United States since the Federal Reserve Board was put into place on Jekyll Island was that we have had consistent inflation. The CPI index, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, tends to understate inflation. We have the Consumer Price Index. There's also a Producer Price Index. And the Producer Price Index, and again, I go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics for the definition. Let me quote from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Producer Price Index is a family of indexes that measures the average change over time in the selling prices received by domestic producers of goods and services. PPI measures price change from the perspective of the seller. This contrasts with other measures, such as the Consumer Price Index, that measure price changes from the purchaser's perspective. Sellers and purchasers' prices may differ due to government subsidies, sales, and excise taxes, and distribution costs. Over 10,000 PPIs for individual products and groups of products are released each month. PPIs are available for the products of virtually every industry in the mining and manufacturing sectors of the economy. New PPIs are gradually being introduced for products of industries in transportation, utilities, trade, finance, and service sectors of the economy. All right, well, that tells me there's a lot of producer price indexes for various products. But what I assume is the producer price index, the reported producer price index, is the summation or some mathematical combination of all the individual producer price indexes that they just talked about. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve Board. I was playing chess a few weeks ago with a friend of mine. He has several PhDs. He's retired. He's highly educated. And somehow the subject turned to the Fed and what the Fed is doing. And I said, well, you understand the Fed is not part of the U.S. government. He said, oh, really? I said, that's correct. He said, the Fed is owned by the member banks. He said, well, what does that mean? I said, well, the Fed is a private organization, not a government organization. It is owned by the member banks. Well, who owns the member banks? Well, the member banks are owned by the stockholders of the banks. And so the largest stockholders of the banks own the Federal Reserve. And I said, the Federal Reserve has a monopoly on printing money. He said, well, no, that doesn't make any sense at all. And I said, well, that's how it works out. The Federal Reserve was set up under the Wilson administration, I think in 1912. And it gave a monopoly to the banks, who in turn control the Federal Reserve, to print money. He said, no, the Secretary of Treasury, the Treasury Department of the United States prints money. I said, no, that's not correct. The Treasury Department, the U.S. Treasury, when it needs money, it sells T-bills, T-notes, and T-bonds. And whoever buys those bonds gives the money to the government to spend as it pleases. Now, if there's no buyers for that bond, guess who tends to step in and buy those bonds when there's no demand for those bonds? Well, the Federal Reserve does. So I want you to do this before we go much farther. Pull out any bill that you may have in your wallet, and I'm doing it myself, and I happen to have a $5 bill. What the bill says is it's a Federal Reserve note. That's debt. A note is debt. And who signs that note? In the lower right-hand corner of this $5 bill, it's the Secretary of Treasury. So the Secretary of Treasury has taken upon the obligation of you and I as taxpayers to pay back this note. This is a note. This is what passes for currency. Currency in the United States is created by debt. There's a little bit of controversy to how the Federal Reserve was actually set up. A bunch of guys got together on Jekyll Island, Georgia, for 10 days in 1910. They were executives of the bank representing J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Kuhn Loeb and Company. And the man organizing this was the Senate Republican leader, Nelson Aldrich. Now, Nelson Aldrich was married to the daughter of John D. Rockefeller. So when you hear conspiracy theorists talk about the creation of the Fed, I think there's a little basis to that. Nonetheless, we've been saddled with the Federal Reserve Board since 1912, and we need to understand how it works. Well, since I just discussed that the Federal Reserve has the monopoly on printing money, on creating money out of thin air, how does it do this? Well, it does this by buying debt from banks primarily. So when the Federal Reserve Board buys debt, U.S. Treasury bills, Treasury notes, Treasury bonds that are owned by banks, they are creating money. Where does that money come from? It comes out of thin air. It's created instantaneously. The money they use to buy the debt is created. It goes back to the banks, and the banks have to do something with that money. They can loan it out, or they can go buy other securities and put in the bank's balance sheet. That's it, pure and simple. So that's an example of how you actually create money and put more money into the economy. When the Federal Reserve wants to tighten the money supply, then it does the opposite. It sells bonds, notes, or bills to the individual banks and takes money from the banks. That's it. The man or woman behind the curtain, that's all they are doing. Now, let's talk about what open market operations of the Fed are. Well, the Fed controls the supply of money, and they control interest rates. How do they control interest rates? Well, first of all, they announce what interest rates are going to be, and the market reacts. If the market doesn't react as much as the Fed wants it to react, it will simply make it happen. For instance, if the Fed wants interest rates to go down to below 1%, it simply creates money out of thin air and goes to the bank or goes to the open market and buys and buys and buys Treasury securities until they get down to where they want them to be. And of course, they can buy as much as they want because they can create as much money out of thin air as they want. Vice versa, if they want interest rates to go up, they will go into the open market and sell and sell and sell until the interest rates arrive at what they want them to be at. That's it. It's not rocket science. It's pretty damn simple. But so few people understand this. And probably the reason that it's really not talked about is it sounds too good to be true. If you can create money by just conjuring it out of thin air, where's the value of money? Well, money is an illusion. Money is simply an agreement between people to accept it in return for goods and services. As long as that illusion, as long as that trust is maintained, money has value. There was a time when money actually had tangible value. That was when we were on the silver and gold standard. I remember as a child, when I had a quarter, it was a silver quarter. In 1964, the Federal Reserve decided that that was too expensive to actually have tangible value backing up the currency was costing it too much money because it wanted to create more currency than we had precious metals to do. So what did they do? They now tried to make it look like a silver quarter, but it was a copper quarter. And the same with silver dollars. Now, when Nixon spent money like crazy fighting the Vietnam War and deficit spent, he devalued the currency by taking the U.S. off the gold standard. So as it is today, there is absolutely nothing backing the value of a dollar except for the productive capacity of America. That's what creates the value for the currency. Now, since the Federal Reserve has been in business, and I call it a business because it's a private organization, we've had a consistent inflationary period. The value of the dollar today is a fraction of what a dollar was worth in 1912. And why is that? It's because we keep printing more money. It's pretty simple. If you look just in my lifetime, when I was a child, a postage stamp was 3 cents. I'm not sure if it was 3 cents or 5 cents, but it was one of those two. Today, it's over 41 cents. It's the same service, exactly the same service. To me, that's a definition of severe inflation over my lifetime. My dollar is worth about 20% of what it would have been worth in 1960. So how does that happen? Well, as you keep putting more and more money into the economy, you're basically devaluing the existing money that's already out there. Think about it this way. We've studied stocks. When a company does a split on a stock, let's say a 2-for-1 split, the value of that stock in the open market declines. Why do we think that we can create money and the value of money doesn't decline? Well, that's the Federal Reserve in a nutshell. Let's talk about the money supply. There's three components of money supply. There's M1, M2, and M3. M1, the most common definition when people are talking about the money supply, is simply currency in circulation plus checking deposits. Those are called demand deposits as well. So that's the most common measure of the money supply. The Fed can control M1 by just buying and selling securities. M2 is M1 plus deposits in savings accounts of under $100,000. And M3 is M1 plus M2 plus deposits of over $100,000. So M3 is the broadest measure of the money supply. There's a website out there sponsored by the Federal Reserve where you can go to get statistics that I use quite a bit when I'm doing analysis on my macroeconomic point of view. And that's the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. The Federal Reserve has several banks around the country. I don't think you need to know where they're located, but there's one in San Francisco, there's one in St. Louis, there's one in New York. The New York one is the most influential of the Federal Reserve banks. And of course, you have the Federal Reserve building, which is just opposite the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. That's where the headquarters of the Federal Reserve are. Now, again, there's that illusion that they're part of the U.S. government, but that's just an illusion. They are not part of the U.S. government. The President of the United States appoints the Board of Governors and the Director of the Federal Reserve, yet the people proposed for these spots are put forth by the Federal Reserve itself, by the member banks themselves. Now, the president doesn't have to appoint those people, but he typically does. He typically appoints somebody that is related to the Federal Reserve system from within. There has been no audit of the Federal Reserve, yet the Federal Reserve Act requires that any profit made by the Federal Reserve be returned to the U.S. Treasury. However, there's no audit, so we really don't know whether that's the case. But let's just think about this conceptually for a minute. The Federal Reserve could create any profit it really wanted to. It could sell and sell and sell securities into the market and collect interest rates on those. How the Fed would actually make money could be done a number of ways, but there's no audit of the Fed, so we don't really know how much money they're making and if that's accurate or not. Remember, the Fed can create any money it wants. So any expenses the Fed has, they just create out of thin air. They can pay for those expenses just by creating the money. It's a great business if you can get it. They can also affect reserve requirements for banks. They are responsible for regulating banks. But of course, who owns a Federal Reserve? The banks. So they set reserve requirements for banks, how much banks have to have in cash for all the loans that they write. That's called the reserve requirements. They can raise or lower reserve requirements. They set the federal funds rate, which is the rate which is an overnight rate that member banks charge each other for overnight loans. Now, the federal funds rate is the lowest interest rate in the economy. Another rate they'll sometimes talk about is the discount rate. The discount rate is the rate at which member banks can borrow reserves directly from the Fed. And it used to be called the discount window, and I guess it still is called the discount window. The discount rate is usually about 1% higher than the Fed funds rate in a normal interest rate environment. Today, it's 0.75%. The Fed funds rate is 0.25%. And the prime rate is another rate you need to know. And the prime rate is the rate at which banks will loan money to their best, their top, their most creditworthy customers. And today, the prime rate is 3.25%. There's a term called the velocity of money. And the velocity of money is how fast money changes hands from one person to the next person to the next person. The velocity of money is a big component in the creation or lack of creation in inflation. A low velocity of money would lead to deflation. A high velocity of money would tend to lead to inflation. The St. Louis Fed has a lot of statistics that you can go into, and you can create your own graphs and try to determine whether we're in an inflationary or a deflationary environment. But they also have the velocity of M2. Now, you're going to have questions on M1, M2, and M3. M1 is a definition of all the currency in the economy plus checking deposits. M2 is M1, which is currency plus checking deposits, plus time deposits under $100,000. And M3 is M1 plus M2 plus money market instruments and savings bonds. There's a great podcast out there that I'm going to recommend that you listen to and listen to his discussion of the Federal Reserve Board. And that podcast is, it's called The Wandering Economist, and you can find it in iTunes. He goes into great detail about the Federal Reserve, what M1 is, what M2 is, what M3 is, what reports he puts out. He does a great job. So let me suggest you find that. He hasn't put out any new podcasts since 2007, but he talks about the Bretton Woods Agreement in one podcast. He talks about M1, M2, and M3. I'll put a link in the show notes to that podcast. All right, we talked about the Fed funds rate, the prime rate, the discount rate. There's a couple other rates we need to talk about. The broker loan rate, sometimes it's called the call loan rate. And this is the rate that banks charge to brokers on loans where they use securities as collateral. Now, the broker loan rate is different than the margin interest rate that the broker may charge its customers. The margin interest rate that the broker may charge its customers may be higher. It would not be lower. All right, let's get back to the velocity of money. And I did that little side note on M1, M2, and M3 because we needed to know what those were, because the velocity of money is a measurement of M2. And the velocity of money is how fast a dollar changes hands. And right now, it's right around between 1.5 and 1.6. And it's been as high as 2.2 back in, looks like about 98, back just before the collapse, the first dot-com collapse. And then it was also quite high in, it was over 2 in 2008, just before the collapse of the market. And there has been a consistent decline in the velocity of money since 2008. What the velocity of money tends to indicate is that people are worried about spending. So they're holding on to their money. That's it, plain and simple. When people are spending their money and it's changing hands from one person to the next, that means they're not worried about it. Or on the other side of that, that means they want to get rid of their money and buy something of value, some tangible product, before the money loses value. You saw that in the high inflation countries, in Argentina, in Zimbabwe, in the Weimar Republic in Germany. People wanted to get rid of their money and buy something of tangible value because money is an illusion. Money is something people trust. Money creates its value from the ability of it to be exchanged for goods and services. And if that trust is ever lost, then the value of money is subject to interpretation. So you sort of want the velocity of money to be good, but not too good.
but you don't want it to be bad because that tends to be deflationary. Now, why has the Federal Reserve pumping dollars into the economy? Because people aren't spending the money that they're holding. They're hoarding money right now. So the velocity of money is as low as it has been on this graph that I'm looking at, and this goes back to before 1960. In 1960, the velocity of money was about 1.8. The website is the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. You can create your own commodities index graphs. You can create any graph you pretty much want to. And I did this when I created a report for my clients not too long ago. And it was the report I put out to my clients was, we're hearing a lot of arguments on inflation versus deflation. So I went to the St. Louis Fed website and created my own graphs to try to draw my own conclusion as to whether we were in a deflationary environment or an inflationary environment. First of all, I did a graph on energy, on the price of energy, the price of food, the price of taxes, which aren't included in the CPI, the price of industrial commodities. And what I found was, let me just read it from my report. And if you hear paper in the background, it's because I'm looking at this report I created for my clients. I'm just going to read one paragraph from the report I sent to my clients. My inflation argument is based on data. Real disposable personal income has only increased at an annualized rate of 1.04%, while inflation statistics, as measured by the official CPI, has grown 2.1%. But the real story of inflation is not reported in the core CPI, energy, food, and taxes, the essentials of life. Over the past 10 years, the annualized inflation rate on energy has been 26.92% a year, food 3.14% a year, and taxes 7.54%. The official CPI rate is 2.1%, and it ignores the real costs. All right, and that's data directly from the St. Louis Fed website. You can create economic indicators from pretty much anything, but there's some that are widely accepted as being leading indicators and lagging indicators of the economic index. My wife drives to and from work every day, and she goes by a blood bank every day. And I've always thought that we should create a blood bank leading or lagging indicator. My guess is it would be a lagging indicator because after people lose jobs, they go give their blood if they need some money. But that could be an indicator. Let's talk about the most common indicators out there. The Consumer Confidence Index is considered a leading economic indicator. It's supposed to measure how comfortable people feel, what their confidence is in the future, their own future, their economic future. It's put out by the Conference Board, an independent economic research organization, and they survey 5,000 households. In 1985, they set the benchmark index to 100. So that's where everything is measured off of, is that 100. And the reason they chose that year is because it was neither a peak nor a trough in the economic cycle. I'm looking at a graph on it. In 1966, obviously the consumer confidence had increased. It was quoted at 140. It got down to about less than 30 in 2008. And the most recent consumer confidence index reading as of this recording is 100.21. The consumer confidence index is issued monthly. So the consumer confidence index is issued monthly. A number higher than 100 means people are confident. Lower than 100 means people are unconfident. Another close one to the Consumer Confidence Index is the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. It's run by the University of Michigan. It's published monthly, and it uses a 1966 value as 100. They interview 500 people in creating the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. Another leading indicator is the Help Wanted Advertising Index. That is also issued by the Conference Board. They measure the level of help wanted ads in 51 cities. So if there's an increase from period to period, that tends to be positive. If there's a decrease, that would be negative. If it's flat, that means it's stable. The economy is stable, neither increasing nor decreasing for that period of time. Now, the Conference Board publishes a whole bunch of indicators. Some are leading, some are lagging. The leading indicators, I'm just going to read you a list here. The Index of Consumer Expectations, Contracts for Plant and Equipment, Delivery Delays by Vendors, Building Permits, the Length of the Manufacturing Work Week, Initial Claims for Unemployment, and New Consumer Goods Orders. The lagging indicators are employment duration, reported corporate profits, the ratio of consumer credit to income level, commercial loans outstanding, labor cost per manufactured unit, inventory to sales ratio. That's an important one. That's going to finish up today's lesson. We've covered a lot here. Thanks for listening. Again, please sign up for the email list and get the 20-some page outline of what you need to study in order to pass the Series 7 exam. Also, if you're interested in sailing with me, write me a note, franz1@medsailor.com or franz@series7podcast.com. Good luck on the 7. Keep studying.